This episode of The Tome Show is brought to you by FRP Games, where you can find overstock discounts from 30 to 90% off. Noble Knight Games, where you can find where Out of Print is available again. And listeners like you, thanks for using The Tome's Amazon store.
Hey, this is Mike Merles, lead developer of 4th Edition, and you're listening to The Tome.
Welcome to The Tome, episode 140. The Tome is a D&D news, reviews, and interview show, and I'm your Tome host, Jeff Greiner. In this episode, we're going to fight the remnants of dead gods, princes of elemental evil, a spider queen, and apes? As we look at Monster Manual 3. And in this episode, I am joined by two of my favorite guests. First up, say hello to Quinn Murphy from At Will.
Hey, how you doing? Glad to be back.
It's good to have you here, sir. It's always a pleasure. And we also have with us the expert from Sly Flourish, Mike Shea.
Hey, glad to be here.
It's always good to have either one of you on and to have the two of you together here. I feel like we're, you know, the three amigos ready to hash it out.
It's been a long time since the three of us were on one, hasn't it?
Yeah.
It's hard to convince Mike to come on. He's a little bit of an elitist. He's a bit of a snob.
Well, that's true.
Well, plus there's the issue of you want to focus on DM stuff, so.
Yep.
All right. To start off with, let's talk a little bit about D&D news. I haven't chatted up news for a while, so I've got a few different little things to mention in the world of D&D news. First of all, if you're somebody who reads D&D novels, there's been some pretty significant changes in the staff over at Wizards of the Coast for D&D novels, specifically Phil Athens, who's kind of been the guy in charge of the novel lines for some time, has been let go from the company. And it's a little bit sad, and I wish him luck. And more than that, it makes me worry a little bit of the novel lines. You know, are they going to continue at the same strength they've been publishing when they're cutting staff and losing some of their major people? Do either of you guys read any of the D&D novels?
Not for a while. Honestly, I'm generally more into just the general books. It's been years since I picked one up.
Yeah, I read them. I mean, they got me into D&D, the Salvador Icewind Dale stuff.
Yep.
And I read them a lot through high school and college, but I haven't read anything recently. I've had kind of a hard time figuring out where to start back in again. Mm.
I'll tell you what, the latest Salvatore Drizzt novel is, in my opinion, one of the best ones he's written.
Really?
And it was interesting because he wrote Pirate King and Ghost King are the latest two.
Right.
And I didn't really like Pirate King at all.
It's not all Drizzt pontification of his life and then fancy footwork?
It's not all of that. I mean, obviously that's part of it, right? Because it's a Drizzt novel.
Yeah.
But Ghost King does a nice job of taking a lot of the things I really like from a Drizzt novel, because you have certain expectations from those
sure.
books, right? And it takes all those expectations and ratchets them up to 11, you know?
That's cool.
You know, it's like, it takes me back to when I was in middle school or high school and I really liked these books because I looked at them and was like, wow, really? You've got an undead lich dragon with an artifact for a horn? And it's psionic? You know?
Whatever happened to Caddy Bray? Did she die? Is that a spoiler?
I haven't heard that name in a long
let's
time.
Let's not spoil that. That all right. Whether or not she lives is...
She must be 100 years old.
It is a major story point in the last book.
Okay.
And in terms
she's a lich.
In terms of storylines, this last novel, The Ghost King, also sort of helps us understand what the spell plague was in the Forgotten Realms, because it happens during the spell plague.
Oh, that's cool.
You know, and it, the story is not about the spell plague. It's sort of that's the setting of what's going on in this story. But so yeah, at this point, she's not 100 years old. Okay, other news, and also book related. There are previews starting to come out of the new D&D comic book, and I will link the page that has those previews for, in the show notes for people who want to look at them. They've got several pages from the comic up there. They've tried a lot of D&D comics off and on for 20, 30 years now, and I'm kind of curious to see how this one does. I know I've always checked out all the previous ones, and some of them I've really liked and some of them I haven't, and some of that may be also the fact that I've gotten older with time, you know, and my expectations for what I want to read have changed. Have either of you ever read a D&D comic?
Yes. I'm in a similar boat to you. Like, you know, I used to have quite the comic habit. Like, if it basically fit between cheap paper and had pictures on it, I bought it. So I definitely read lots of D&D, whatever. But just these days, not so much. But if they put it, do we know if it's going to be on the iPad? Because I'll buy it.
Yeah, I'd buy it then.
It's digital.
It might be. I know it's being published by IDW.
Uh-huh.
And the company that does most of the iThing.
I use Comixology, yeah, and they have a lot of IDW stuff there.
Yeah, Comixology, I was going to say, is the company that does most of that stuff. And I think they publish some IDW, so there's a good chance.
Well, I'll just say, anybody from Wizards or IDW there, you know, I know you really want my sale in particular. So if you want to put it on iPad, I'll buy it.
Yep.
I haven't been sold on the iPad yet, but I'm getting really close.
You'll get there.
We've been having a conversation on the Vorpal Network forums about that, about digital comics specifically, because I collect almost exclusively DC comics, and they've just released the DC Comics app like a week ago.
Right.
So right now, it's looking good. I like it, and I've said that I will buy an iPad just for my comics reading, because just to save storage space.
Sure.
You know, I add a long box of comics every year.
The problem is the titles aren't quite there yet.
There's still a lot of B-list stuff. I want to be able to get everything that I currently get, or at least pick and choose what I want to get.
Kingdom Come on it or something.
Well, not even that. I want to be able to say, you know, I collected these five titles right now, and I want them all. I want the new ones, you know. And right now there's only just a handful of titles that they have. So anyway, that's different news than D&D news, but
related.
Yes. So the D&D comics coming out, it looks in terms of artwork similar to the most recent D&D comics from what I've seen, which is interesting. And I don't know if they brought in some of the same people to work on it or not. But there was a series of D&D comics that came out during the third edition days that were okay. You know, they didn't blow my mind, but they were decent. And the ultimate villain in one of the storylines was blue dragons, and I like blue dragons, so that helped. Other news is Orcus has been released. He's out in the world and wreaking havoc and expensive.
Yes.
Did either of you buy Orcus?
Of course.
We both did, yeah.
Yeah.
I knew Mike would, because he's our I spend lots of money on miniatures and terrain and all that kind of stuff guy, so...
I also spend lots of money on miniatures, just in private.
And I like so to put I mine on Flickr.
I did not buy Orcus. I would like to spend more money on miniatures, but as it is, I know what my limitations are in terms of wifely duties. So. I think if I were to start buying a lot of those things, like an $80 Orcus.
Yeah, I mean, the big thing for me is I'm actually going to be using him at the end of a campaign coming up in 10 weeks. So, and it's a 1-30 campaign, and he's been the main villain the whole time.
Sure.
So it fit perfectly for me, but yeah. I'd have a hard time buying him if I wasn't going to be using him.
Yeah, and that's
I'm going to be trying to find a reason to use him.
Yeah, and see, I have some places where I could be using him, but maybe. It's a maybe, and it's a if I do, it'll be in a year or more, you know?
Right.
So I have a hard time justifying that kind of a purchase.
Right.
Yeah, I was just afraid that he was going to be like one of the Red Dragon things where you're like, yeah, I'll buy that one day. And by the time that one day comes where you're like, I would really like that, they're like $500 on eBay.
Yeah, and this one is a limited run. I mean, they're only making so many. So I figure, what the hell?
Yeah.
But the main thing is, like, I figure it's going to be like $35. It's going to be like $35 a battle. Yeah. His cost per table time. Maybe you'll get to use them two or three times, but but you could use them as a statue and some other things you could do with them.
Right. Okay, other things, upcoming releases this month, the big releases from WotC this month are Demonomicon and the Tomb of Horrors, the Super Adventure, which Mike informs me is different than the Tomb of Horrors that people got as their DM rewards for Living Forgotten Realms.
Yes, that is true. Very different,
and I'm looking forward to that. One of my the first third edition campaigns I played in was a Tomb of Horrors game that was a play by email, so everything moved slower, but it just went forever. And so I'm looking forward to seeing the fourth edition take on the Tomb of Horrors. I'm also really looking forward to the Demonomicon because I'm a glutton for demons and devils.
Yep.
So plus Brian R. James has promised me for months that he's going to come on and talk about it.
Very cool.
Nice. Yeah, I'm eager for both of those. But Tomb of Horrors is probably my top one. There, I'm going to pick them up both. I think I'm most excited to see Tomb of Horrors. There should be pretty awesome, and hopefully it's living up to the moniker and just is going to be like a super grinder,
yeah,
for players, and just we can sort of dispel some of that 4E is too easy kind of stuff.
Well, and see,
I'm one of the people that says that, so I'll be looking forward to seeing it.
Yeah,
I think it's interesting that Wizards of the Coast has gone this direction though, because this is them figuring out how to get my sales. You know, I don't buy most published adventures unless I specifically plan on running them, you know? So the vast majority of the Wizards of the Coast D&D adventures, I've never seen.
Right.
Other than sitting on a shelf, you know? But when they put out a hardcover, you know, super adventure, I buy those.
Right.
You know, and I buy them all, and I have since third edition, so.
Right.
That's how they get my sale out of it, is do big super adventures instead of do little softback published adventures. Otherwise, I like to, you know, part of the reason I like to play D&D is that I like to tell stories, and I like to tell my stories, so that's why I usually don't do pre-published adventures.
Yeah, from what I understand, they're doing something pretty cool with it, that there's actually three different levels of play, like a 5, a 15, and a 25, so you could either have it intermixed within a larger campaign, or you could actually have characters make these 10-level jumps during you running the adventure, which I think actually opens things up for a lot of interesting storytelling, because you have all of this background story between those 10 levels. So it looks like it could fit really well as a nice mini campaign, or it could fit, you know, it could really tie together a much longer campaign. So it looks pretty cool.
Sweet. Any other D&D news that I'm missing before I go on to some network news?
I think you caught it.
Yep. All right.
I think that's more D&D news than we've talked about in a long time, so... network news, the Vorpal Network has expanded. We've added actually two new members, but one recently and one a while ago that I just kind of neglected to mention. The Power Source podcast is a show hosted by Jared Glenn that talks about 4th edition D&D. It gives a lot of news, some interesting insights, talks a lot about what's going on in a lot of detail. It runs sometimes up to 2 hours long and comes out every single week. So, you know, if you're looking for a lot of D&D content, it's a good show to check out. And the other show that recently joined us is the Icosahedrophilia podcast, the most difficult name to spell in podcasting.
Yeah, well done.
I've gotten good at pronouncing it. I'm just not so good at spelling it.
Say that again.
Icosahedrophilia.
Wow.
And that is in my opinion, probably the best 4th edition actual play podcast that's ever been produced.
Mm-hmm.
Chris Hurd, the host, breaks up each game session into one-hour episodes, usually 5 or 6 one-hour episodes. Each one has an introduction, then the actual play, and then follows it up with sort of a mini review segment of a product they used in that session, you know, miniatures, maps, that kind of thing. Or it might be of something that's of interest to that game session. You know, so if they're dealing with the astral plane in that session, maybe he'll talk about plane above. Or sometimes he just goes back and says, look, you heard this happen in the game. Let me kind of explain what was going on and what I was thinking as a DM and where the story's going. And so you get some really interesting insights into all that. I really like Icosahedrophilia as an actual play show.
Yeah.
Either one of you listen to either of those?
I have in the past. Yeah. I don't listen to them regularly.
Yeah, I'm behind on a good portion of my podcast there, because I'm officially the worst person in the world. But I do like that. What I've heard of it, I do like a lot.
Is there a standards body to determine you're the worst person in the world, or how do you become official at something like that?
I mean, it's one of those things that really just sort of works off a system of self-proclamation.
I think I'd like to see some paperwork.
Then paperwork you shall have.
Maybe that could be the next temporaryhitpoints.com poll of the month. Who is the worst person in the world? And, you know, we'll put Quinn up there and Mike and...
Hey.
You know, whoever else thinks of themselves as the worst person in the world. Speaking of which, we've just completed our first month at temporaryhitpoints.com, the new site that I started that's focused on the 4th edition D&D player. We've got advice for role-playing, character creation, new rules, like a new race that I created. Well, kind of a new race that I created. And in fact, I believe one of our guests wrote an article this last month. Quinn, can you tell us what you wrote about?
Yes. I wrote an article called A Simple Question. And it's about one of my characters, probably my favorite character I've ever played. As a player, Umali the Mad, who is a half-orc wizard, and just some interesting stuff. You know, I made a good background with him, but didn't really know anything about him until I asked a simple question. Now, what that question is and what happened from it, I'll leave as an exercise for the reader when they go and check it out at the site. But I'm really happy with it. It was fun to write and sort of fun to recall some of those things.
Sweet. So you can check that out at temporaryhitpoints.com and a lot of the other stuff that we've talked about over at vorpalnetwork.com. I think that covers the news. Let's move on and get into these things that we're going to talk about today. Our conversation is going to be about Monster Manual 3. It is primarily, as you would expect, a new collection of creatures that a DM can use to kill PCs. I mean, challenge PCs.
Yay.
But it's a little bit more than that. It betrays some new concepts that are being used in terms of building monsters, some changes behind the math and some of the behind-the-scenes things that bring these creatures to us, along with new format for stat blocks. And we're going to talk all about that right after I mention our first sponsor of the episode, FRP Games. FRP Games offers significant discounts on most of their products, and very good discounts on their Overstock products of 30% to 90% off. I have personally, I like shopping there because I'm looking for one book. I'll get that one book, and then I was like, oh well, let's go to the discount area and find just a couple of really cool looking miniatures, because at 40% off, 50% off, you know, for a few extra bucks, I can get a couple of cool miniatures while you're shipping me this box, why don't you add a few of those in there, kind of thing. It's a little addictive. My pick for this episode from FRP Games is Monster Manual 2. Since we're talking about Monster Manual 3, I thought it would be worth pointing out that they carry the backlog of D&D products, including Monster Manual 2, which also has some fantastic creatures in it. So check that out at FRP Games, which you can get to by going to thetomeshow.com and clicking on the banner.
FRP Games is an online retailer specializing in all aspects of your tabletop gaming needs. Whether it's RPGs, dice, war games, or computer games, FRP Games has a wide selection of products. They offer overstock items where you can pick up all kinds of gaming gear ranging from 30% off all the way up to 90% off the retail price. Through our website, you'll be directed to their weekly new products, eBay auctions, or you can even buy your special gaming someone a gift certificate. FRP Games is an authorized Wizards of the Coast retailer and for 10 years has been committed to providing each customer with the highest standard of customer service possible. Visit our website for instant access to FRP Games inventory of thousands of unique gaming items.
Okay. There's the sponsors. Now it's time, or the first sponsor anyway, and now it's time to get into the meat of this episode. We've chatted, we've been funny, we've talked about the news, we've made fun of Quinn.
Yay.
Now it's time to look at Monster Manual 3. Let's start off by talking about what's in the book.
Monsters.
Monsters. That's
it's full of player options.
Yeah.
Silly.
There's no
players.
Player options.
It's for GMs.
have you noticed that in Monster Manual 1, people liked the idea of all the little NPC stat blocks and things in the back that you could use to make PC races, and they've since then they've completely stopped doing that.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't mind that too much. You know, this, let the players get their own book. They get the whole handbooks. So they can get all of that. It's for us as GMs to come and sit at the party.
Well, I think it works well anyway because I think a lot of people misuse that concept, you know, because those weren't really intended to be for players. They were intended to be for building NPCs.
Right.
So what is in this book? I mean, it is just pretty much cover to cover monsters. You got your short introduction at the beginning that is the same more or less introduction that you see at the beginning of every monster manual, you know, how to read the stat blocks and all that. But then it's just cover to cover new monsters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a lot more flavor text in this one there, and there it has been in the previous monster manuals, and I think a lot of people really like that.
Mm-hmm.
Do you mean flavor text in the stat block or flavor text?
No, actual descriptions of the creatures, yeah. You know, multi-paragraph descriptions of each of the creatures where that was stripped down a lot from the previous ones, and people really felt like there was not nearly as much fluff as there should have been.
Well, it looks like they got the extra space to do that because they cut out the encounter groups.
Yeah, yep. Right. And I never really used those. So
I never did.
Me neither.
I think the only thing I'd like about that is I always feel like any flavor text, any fluff should be flavor text written so that I can just read it aloud. You know, they have some pretty good sections of lore where if somebody rolls arcana checks or religion checks, you know, you can read it aloud. But why not make the whole thing so I can read it aloud?
Real quick tangent on that. I have a question for you. When somebody at your table says, "Can I make a arcana check on this monster?" Do you use the knowledge, monster knowledge, and give them, you know, the name, race, keywords, you know, whatever, and all that information, and then make then they have to do a separate check for the lore, or do you roll it all together, or how do you handle that?
Nobody's really asked to do that in my home game. I've only really seen that in RPGA games where they get all the stats and then they usually make separate rolls. Mm-hmm.
I usually lump them all together.
Yeah, I mean, I like to lump them together, but I often forget, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I kind of don't like that you can just, you know, learn exactly what someone's powers and resists are. I mean, I'm sure the players kind of like that, but it really kind of breaks the story. You know, to say like, oh, he's got resist 15 cold. He has a standard action called seething cold, and he has a triggered action called unfettered apocalypse. It's like, well, that's lame.
Yeah, and there are some places where that makes sense, and there's other places where it doesn't make sense for it to happen all the time.
Right.
Ironically, I wrote an article about this that should be appearing on the Atwell blog shortly.
Yeah, tomorrow.
There you go. So,
you guys are posting all over each other's blogs.
We do that. Yeah, we're crazy that way. In any case, so what stands out to you in this big book of monsters? What do we notice specifically when we look through this one?
This is just I'm just really happy with this one. It's just like there's some crazy stuff, and like in the history of monster manuals, not just fourth ed, but like going through like D&D generally, like there comes that sort of stage where it's like they've run out of all the normal monsters in an edition, and then you just start getting like weird
Yeah.
And then, like, most of those are failures. But I feel all the new things that go here, only a very small minority of the things are things that I am, like, looking at and going, I don't think
so. Why would I ever use that? Yeah.
Yeah. But a lot of the new stuff, even the stuff that's just really weird, I'm like, how could I, like, find some way to get that in there? They really sort of the experiments have a high ratio of success to me anyways.
Yeah, and I tend to agree. I look through it and I say, oh, they did a really nice job of – I mean this is the Monster Manual with this one and the previous two. I now feel like I have the standard core of monsters that I've used in all my previous, you know, campaigns or whatever, because they've given me the various types of giants. You know, I've got my fire giants and my hill giants and all that kind of stuff. They've given me elementals in the format that I'm used to from previous editions.
Finally, normal elementals.
Right.
Right.
You know, they've given you a lot of those kinds of things, those standards that you always used to use that they didn't give us, you know, right away. Now we finally have them. But then they also do a nice job of giving you a handful of relatively new things. And I think when we get to the inspiration section most of us picked relatively new things to talk about.
Yeah, I noticed that's just got lots and lots and lots of epic tier monsters. And that, for me, I was really, really happy to open it up and see so many epic tier monsters, because I'm running a pretty big epic tier campaign right now. And the day I bought it, I was able to use it at the table and throw some really cool new creatures at my group.
Yeah.
So that, for me, was what stood out the most, was there's a lot of high-level cool high level monsters in this,
and three unique,
yeah,
high level epic tier solos. You know, usually we get one.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. Right.
This time we got three,
four.
Did we get four?
Yeah.
Which one am I missing? I've got
Imix.
Imix, Ogre Mock, and
Planet guy, Aberranth.
Oh,
And Alibar. Sorry.
Yeah, Alibar.
Opener of the way.
And speaking of Alibar. One of the things I like there is that they, with Alibar and Ogremonk specifically, they start building more mythology into it. They sort of start tying it to other stuff. They come with sort of related monsters.
Yeah, they kind of come with a campaign attached to it.
Yes.
Right. Well, and Ogremonk has a lot of history to him.
Right.
Because he's...
Yeah, he's an elder elemental lord or what's...
All the way back to the Temple of of Elemental Evil, he's one of the princes, elemental princes,
right?
Along with Imix is also an elemental prince that fell in with Thurisdun and became all kinds of trouble.
Yeah, and I'm going to be reskinning him and using him in my campaign pretty soon. I hope none of my players are listening, but I'm pretty excited about that.
Now, but I also found it interesting that, on one hand, you've got a lot of really high-level, epic, you know, prince of the elemental chaos sort of things going on, Loth, the Spider Queen, and all, you know, all that kind of stuff. But then they also – I was surprised by some of the mundanity, you know, some of the really normal sort of things. Like I mentioned in the intro, the entry for Ape.
You know? Yeah.
or frog, you know, it's like, really? It seems odd that I would have frog and ape in the same book that I have, you know, Imix and Ogremonk. But it works, because that's where I think this book has done a fantastic job, is that it fills in the gaps of things that are useful, but we didn't have before, you know?
Yep.
And because, you know, there are sometimes I need mundane, you know, I need to be tromping through the jungle and run into an ape.
Yeah, I don't know that I'm going to be using apes anytime soon.
Well, you're running up epic level.
Well, I mean, even at a low level, I think I'll find something other than an ape.
Oh, see, right now, it's perfect. My campaign right now, they're trouncing through the jungle.
Right.
Now, the levels are off, right, because they're in the low paragon tier. And so it's not perfectly useful.
But fiendish orcus ape.
Yeah. But no, I can totally see, you know, when you're playing a heroic tier game, a lot of times you need some relatively mundane creatures from the to fight. You know, it can't all be dragons and demons and whatever, because those things, well, those are the cool monsters to fight. Sometimes they're just too strong for the heroic tier.
Right.
Now we've got some other things to fill in those gaps, and I really like that.
Right.
Anything else that stood out to us as we look through what's in this book before we talk about some of the new changes?
The math. I don't know if you're going to plan on talking about the math, but that stood out to me quite a bit.
Let's go to it. Let's talk about the math.
I think it's very noticeable at Epic tier, but I think you start to see it scale. That, I mean, I'm looking at the Maladeus on page 43, and he's a 29 elite soldier, and his basic melee attack does 4d10 plus 15 damage, which is significantly higher than the damage that you typically saw from elite or from epic level creatures. So, in an interview I did with Greg Bilslinden and seeing some of the stuff that he's put on his blog, they talk about the fact that essentially they upped the damage by about 150% for epic tier and paragon tier monsters, which I think is very needed. Mm-hmm. I was really happy to see that.
And I wonder if I know they're going to update the adventure tools and the monster builder.
Yeah, but I don't
for DDI subscribers. But are they going to change the math as well?
I don't think so. I think we're going to be doing that on our own, and that's a little, you know, kind of a disappointment. But it's pretty easy to do. I mean, Greg gave a little bit of a formula that you can do, which is anytime you have a normal creature that's paragon and epic tier, double its static damage modifier. So if it's normally plus 10, 2d12 plus 10 damage, you would turn it into 2d12 plus 20. And that's a safe bit of math that you can do to get the damage kind of closer to where it should be.
Yeah. Huh.
And at the same time as increased that they increased damage, they also decreased hit points. Is that right?
No. They had already done that in Monster Manual 2.
Right.
And that was mainly for solos. I think for everybody else, the hit points were about right. So generally, if you're running a solo from Monster Manual 1 or any of the stuff that was published around then, including Orcus, you're going to want to reduce the hit points down to 4/5 of what it normally was. But they started doing that a while ago.
Which I understand if for the two of you that have the Orcus Mini, I understand the stats for that Orcus are following the new design philosophy and not just a reprinting of the old stats.
They are probably about Monster Manual 2 level. They do not... They're not Monster Manual 3 level. He's not nearly as tough as he should be.
Okay.
My opinion.
Yeah.
So any other things that change in the math? Is it just an increase of damage?
They actually changed the accuracy too. I think they made creatures more accurate in some circumstances and less accurate in others. And I think they tweaked the defenses for soldiers, which is something that a lot of people had complained about. Mm. That soldiers, if you played a soldier that was 2 or 3 levels higher than your PCs, they weren't going to hit it. Mm-hmm. So I think they lowered some of the defenses on soldiers, and then they tweaked accuracy, but I don't really know how.
Yeah,
and I never really saw much of a problem with that. The main thing for me was they just didn't do enough damage.
Well, my experience, at least at the, because I've played all the way through, I've played consistently from first level up through, we're at 13th or 14th now. In those levels, I find the monsters are significantly more accurate than the PCs.
It could be. It could also be that your PCs haven't quite grabbed onto all of the things that they could grab onto to keep to get their defenses higher.
Yeah, maybe. Because
at the Paragon tier, you start to see a lot of feats and other ways for them, and their stats keep going up and everything like that. That they should be about on par. And that's why you see a lot of Paragon defenses, Paragon defense feats and lightning reflex and fortitude and whatnot that get defenses more in line.
I just find it's not very uncommon for me to say, okay, that was a 30-something against reflex, and everybody just sort of rolls their eyes.
Right.
Yeah,
I get a lot of that too, but I've been getting that for a long time where they kind of throw their hands in the air. But now I'm having players who have 48 AC. Ooh. At level 26, and there's just, the biggest guys in the world aren't hitting them, but they're designed that way. They're designed with a lot of conditional ways to get their defenses up.
Right on.
So.
Cool. What else do we notice? There's one big glaring thing that we need to talk about.
Stat block?
Stat blocks.
Yes. I love the new format.
How is it different, Quinn?
Well, instead of just listing everything down willy-nilly, they actually organize it into traits, standard action, triggered actions, and minor actions, and move
mm-hmm.
as appropriate. So then you can sort of, as a GM, you can look and go, okay, what are the traits? You know, and you can see instantly any auras, any sort of thing that's always on, see what its normal attacks are. You know, you can basically just easily sort of use the stat block to plan your turns.
Yeah, it's much, much better. It's a hair longer.
I was going to say, it seems to me that maybe they avoided this early on because there was a lot of focus at the beginning of 4th edition to reduce the complexity and the size of stat blocks. And these seem pretty consistently bigger than stat blocks we're used to.
I mean, one clear thing they did is on almost all attacks, every attack is now two lines, one for the attack roll and one for the damage roll. Mm-hmm. And those used to be combined into one line. And my assumption is they did pretty good testing and figured out that our eyes parse it better quickly when it's broken out like that than when it's together. But I don't know. I mean, some of them, there's a couple of elite mobs in here where the stat block is almost the entire length of the page.
Yeah,
and you figure that that's going to be a little, even with having it broken out by traits, which I think is great. I mean, it's much easier to run, you know, high level monsters. It's much easier to run them when you know what their traits are and you know what their triggered actions are.
Right. No, and I imagine it's going to be more convenient for somebody like me. I'm going to have to rethink how I do my prep, because usually when I do my prep, I open up the monster builder, I find the monster, I grab an image, and I put it into the document of my notes.
Sure. Right.
And I print it all out, and I've got it all there. Well, now it's going to be even harder to get those all onto the same page or whatever, because they're getting bigger and bigger.
Yeah, if you do any kind of HTML work, there's a style sheet that I use on Sly Flourish, not to pimp my site too early, but there's a style sheet that I use there that's built that I took from another guy, and I can't remember his name offhand, but I credit him. That guy came
Tereskius.
Yeah, that's right. Yep, mm-hmm. yep. You're better than I am. See, you're not the worst human being in the world. Anyway, it's a nice HTML style sheet that you can use to render a stat block. And I've actually been using that to print the new type of stat block on 5x8 cards when I'm making my own monsters.
Right on. Yeah. So anyway, yeah, I like the new stat blocks. I think they're going to be easier to run. I haven't actually had a chance to use them yet because since the book has come out, my group hasn't had a chance to get together. We only got to play once in June, and as sad as that is. But we got a game coming up this weekend, so I'm thinking about switching out a monster.
Yeah, I've used them now three nights, and I've been very happy with them.
Yeah, I know. Way back in the day, one of the early advice episodes, I built an encounter with Chatty DM,
mm-hmm.
and it had a monster in it. And I'm just now getting to the point in my campaign where I'm actually going to run that encounter.
Yeah,
and so I'm now that we're getting there, I'm thinking about changing out my dragon for one of the catastrophic dragons in here,
yeah.
And just so I could open up this book and just play it straight out of the book and see how it goes with the new stat.
It's nice to be able to play straight out of the book again.
Yeah,
it's been a while since I've been able to do that.
But I think we're going to talk more about catastrophic dragons later because somebody's going to chat a little bit about that. Anything else that stands on before we move on?
Can I talk about Lolth briefly?
Absolutely.
All right. So I really like Lolth. Not only is she a classic, and for those who might be sort of new to the D&D mythology there, she's the queen of, you know, the spider queen of the drow.
Queen of the demon web pits.
Yeah, exactly. Ultimate evil and poison and all that stuff. And I really, really like one thing. A lot of stuff in the design of Lolth, I just thought she was just kind of cleverly designed. And then there was a little thing. I term it middle finger mechanics there. and I mean it with all sorts of love. Like, I think it's a great thing to have in there. And what I mean by that is basically she's got an ability. So in general, she, as a theme, she does lots of poison attacks.
Right.
Then she has
ongoing poison damage.
What?
Lots of ongoing poison damage.
Right, lots of ongoing poison damage. And then as one of her traits, if you're taking ongoing poison damage and you hit Lolth, you can't make any saves versus poison mechanic. There's middle finger, right?
But you have a choice, either save or do damage.
Yeah, exactly. You can sort of choose to not do damage or try and do something else, right? It's a mechanic that pushes people to make choices, and I love that. And hopefully we sort of see more, you know, especially with I think those kind of mechanics for solos especially are just critical things that force players to make, you know, a pretty hard choice and sort of gets them into it and makes the game just a little crazier.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, she's awesome. And I mean, she fits. And I'm sure, Quinn, I'm sure you noticed a lot of this. A lot of the high level solos in here really follow a lot of your World Breaker ideas. Mm-hmm. You know, they generate minions. They, you know, affect the whole area around them. They do a lot of things. You know, she shifts into two different forms. Mm-hmm. You know, between combat, and I think it's great. I mean, these are the first real solos I've seen that you would run just them and still really challenge a party, which is something that so far solos really haven't done.
Yeah, it's true.
Yeah, and to help build a campaign around Lolth, they've also not. We have all these old stats for Drow, but we have a bunch of new stats for Drow in here as
yeah.
well. So you could build a campaign, you know, from first level to 30th.
Yeah, I actually ran the Drow from this book in one of my games, and they're very high level. You know, they're actually meant to be her elite forces in the Demon Web pits, so they're all level 25 to 28, mm-hmm. and they're great.
Mm-hmm.
They run really well.
All right. So, any other things that you noticed that you want to talk about?
I think I'm good.
Yep.
All right, then I want to take a quick break here and talk about the return of one of my favorite sponsors of all time, NobleKnightGames.com. They will get you your new game products, including things that – and then they can also get you things that have been out of print since, you know, way back in the day in the 80s and the 70s and the 60s and going back. Or if you want to unload some of your old products or games or books or whatever, you can sell it to them as well. My pick for this episode is Orcus, Prince of Undeath. The new gargantuan D&D miniature of the Demon Prince of the Undead, which both of my guests today already own. It is available in limited availability, but last time I checked, they had it at Noble Knight Games.
He sat on my couch and watched Angel with me yesterday.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, Orcus oversaw me running encounters there, and he sort of kept the players on their best behavior. Now, they're normally pretty good.
He has a Twitter account, too.
Does he?
Twitter.com/Prince of Undeath.
Awesome. Really? That's awesome.
Anybody who ever comes and hangs out at my house, the password for my Wi-Fi has Orcus's name in it as well.
Nice. I mean, is the Orcus Twitter account like Drunk Hulk? Because that would be pretty funny.
Yeah. It's a little bit like that's actually part of my campaign, is that Orcus has a Twitter account, and you know, crafty players can learn more about what he's up to by following his Twitter account, because he just can't stop tweeting.
So do you happen to know who owns that Twitter account?
Yeah, I own it.
Yeah, yeah. That's awesome.
That's awesome.
All right, and so is Orcus, which you can get right now, and other great deals at NobleKnightGames.com.
Orcus is going to get lots of followers.
Noble Knight Games has been serving the needs of thousands of gamers worldwide since 1997. With a huge selection of over 30,000 unique products, including discounts on most in-print games of up to 50% off or more. Noble Knight Games is the place for out-of-print RPGs, board games, war games, collectible card games, miniatures, and all things game-related. They ship worldwide and will purchase or trade your titles you no longer need, new, or used. Your satisfaction is guaranteed. Just visit www.nobleknight.com or visit our website for direct access to thousands of new, out-of-print, and in some cases, one-of-a-kind items.
Before we wrap up, I'm going to use the new inspiration format for this review, where we're each going to take something that we were inspired, that we saw in this book that inspired us, and build something for it or talk about it and tell you guys about it. So I'm going to go ahead and get us started off to give a good example, or a bad example, however you want to look at it. I picked The Forsaken as my source of inspiration. These are a group of basically human-looking people who, during the Dawn War, accidentally sort of absorbed some of the the power and the immortality of the gods when they were killed on the normal worlds, you know, the prime material plane, if you will. And this has sort of tortured them for ages, right? They've gouged out their own eyes and they wear bandages now. And they're epic level creatures with a really interesting story behind them. And I like that they can be used in a lot of sort of complex ways. You could make them epic enemies to fight, but you can also make them people to talk to, and they might actually side with you if your goals align with theirs. And as I'm looking at them, I was also then reminded of a creature from the Plane Above book, the Quam, which I recently statted out as a PC race on temporaryhitpoints.com. Plug, plug, plug. And the Quam have an interesting parallel story, right, where they are looking for bits and pieces of their dead god that were scattered all over the place. And I realized that if you combine these two creatures together as a theme, you can create a whole series of adventures or possibly even a campaign around the concepts of these two characters. You know, the PCs are fighting these guys at different levels as the bad guys. At one level, maybe these two groups are working together, and then later on, because they both hate the gods, so it makes sense they work together. But on the other hand, they both have very different goals about what they want to do while they're fighting along with the gods, and so it all breaks out into a big war, and the PCs get stuck in the middle and don't know which side to help and whatever. And it seems to me like you can combine the innate stories of these two monsters to create a really cool Paragon through Epic Tier campaign. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I came up with.
Yeah, I like them because you can reskin them and turn them into vampires or ghouls and things.
Mm-hmm.
If you need high level vampires and ghouls and things, they're very reskinnable.
They're very good for being an Epic Tier sort of humanoid creature.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So what about you guys? Who wants to go first and tell us what you were inspired by?
Quinn can go first.
Okay. The Banderhop. So I just want to, if you'll pardon me here, I just want to, just to get the feel for this creature. The Banderhop is my favorite critter out of this book. It's everything from the flavor text to the concept, everything wonderful. So I just want to sort of read, just so you know how cool this thing is. All right. As a day recedes, shadows lengthen over the world like grasping claws. That's when the Banderhobs come. Beneath the stars, in the dead of moonless nights, they march in ones and twos from the land of death and darkness. A Banderhob's snaking tongue ensnares his victim, drawing it into the creature's distended maw before it is swallowed into the Banderhob's cavernous stomach. Then the creature departs to where its master waits for it to regurgitate its still-living cargo.
Ugh.
For what purpose? A Banderhob never tells. So then, based off that, there are these basic, you know, and they go on more into the lore that the Banderhobs are like these boogeymen kind of creatures, but way more sinister than just something a child makes up. Like even other denizens of the Shadowfell don't like these guys.
That's where they're from. They're from the Shadowfell.
Yep, they're Shadowfell creatures. So
guys camped out in it.
Yeah. And then so what my idea is like a short, it can be either a short creepy diversion or it could be something that turns into something longer at the discretion of your game. But I like to call this sort of diversion adventure the very, very, very bad dream of Milo Odenham. So the hook of it is that and it's great because it basically has a hook just about anywhere. Basically, it starts when your players come and stay the night in an inn.
Mm-hmm.
And as they're sleeping, sort of this unnatural darkness falls over everything. They're awakened by the sort of, it seems like a ghost, maybe dream form of a young boy who then tells them how the children in the town are actually being kidnapped and replaced. And their parents don't know any of the wiser. And he's asking, and the children are being put to work in these mines. And some of them are changing into, he doesn't know why. So he requests the player's help. And so the only thing that they have left there for their first clue is he leaves them his sort of stuffed animal sort of toy there, which actually sort of has a tie into a shadow portal, a portal to the Shadowfell. And then they follow that, and they have, you know, and that's where they have an encounter with a Banderhob, lurking in the shadows with shadow wolves as his minions, and stuff. And then from there, so what you have from there is you have the option to either extend it where they go into the Shadowfell and try and, you know, go through there and in the mines, maybe meet the Banderhob master, and try and shut things down, or at least just rescue the children. Or you can sort of have them have that creepy encounter, and then they, you know, wake up, but they wake up with the teddy bear. So it's not, you know, so it's not just a full dream. They wake up with a the teddy bear stuffed animal and maybe some other weird thing like the Banderhob's finger. Mm. And so that was my little creepy diversion.
Yeah, that sounds cool.
Awesome. Okay, then, Mike, I think you wanted to get a little draconic on us.
Yeah, I really like the catastrophic dragons. First of all, I think they have awesome – that's an awesome name, you know, the catastrophic dragons. But they did something different here. They made a bunch of different dragons. I think it's three different types, the earthquake dragons, the blizzard dragons, and the volcanic dragons. So you have ice and stone and fire. And instead of having breath weapons, they charge up and explode. I certainly know the volcanic dragon does, but I think they all have an aura that grows. And, you know, throughout combat, this aura expands from them. And in the case of volcanic dragon, it actually blows up, which is pretty cool. They don't have breath weapons, which is a little odd. And they're actually elites instead of solos. So I used these in a game. I had, Quinn was actually in town and sat in on a game that I ran, a couple weeks ago. And, I had a chance to use the volcanic dragon and the earthquake dragon, in a airship, big airship battle. And, I'm kind of glad they were elites, and I'm kind of glad I had two, because one of them just immediately got, I mean, Quinn, you want to say what happened to him?
Whoever is in charge of designing the battle mine. Thank you. I got to basically nerve pinch the earthquake dragon with a mind blade.
Yeah, unconscious save ends. So he got coup de grace four times in one round, and by elite, you know, epic. I'm sorry, by epic tier PC. So it was like 400 damage that he took in one round, and he only has 450 hit points. So he managed to last for about two rounds, and that, you know, he acted as the lightning rod, but the volcanic dragon actually had a mount. The guy that was mounted on him was a reskinned Godslayer Inferno on page 14. And I really like the Inferno. The Inferno has a bunch of different attacks, but the attacks do significant amounts of ongoing damage instead of base damage. So, you know, it has a firebolt that's range 10 plus 31 versus reflex, ongoing 25 fire damage when you hit, which is kind of nice. So what I noticed is that having two dragons that were flying around really spread out the attention of the party. And the explosion mechanic, it didn't quite work as well as I'd hoped. I don't think I ran it quite as well as I could have, because it was kind of complicated. It was the first time I was using them. But it's a neat idea. I like this idea. Again, it kind of goes back to that world breaker philosophy that Quinn has, that you want a monster that's changing the environment around it. So having an aura 5 that does 15 fire damage isn't as cool as one that grows each battle. And I used a little D6 that I put right on the mini to tell me how big that aura was. So I knew whether or not it was fully expanded and blowing up. So I really liked them. I thought the catastrophic dragons were a neat addition to all the dragons that we have now. They're elite. So you can use multiple ones, or you can have an elite one with a bunch of different, you know, servants that are following around, and they have some pretty cool mechanics that are different.
Very cool. Mm-hmm. I think I'm going to go ahead and take that volcanic dragon right out of the book and run it this weekend. So
yeah, he's it's cool.
Yeah, they were definitely really fun.
I'm looking forward to blowing up all over the players. So
right.
All right. Awesome. That's some sources of inspiration and a little actual play report there from somebody who's run some of these monsters. All in all, to summarize sort of what we talked about, I think we really liked some of the gaps that this book fills in for monsters. You know, it gives us a lot of epic, which we feel like we needed, but it also gives us some lower level mundane creatures, which helps round out what we can do with lower level encounters. It gives us a lot of the old monsters that have been missing for the last few years, but also gives us some new ideas and monsters that actually were relatively successful. We like the new damage output, that there's more damage happening, and monsters are more of a threat. And we like the new stat block format, even though it is a little bit bigger. It's going to be a lot easier to read in the middle of a game. Does that sort of summarize what we said about Monster Manual 3 in a nutshell?
Yep.
Yeah, it's my favorite book this year.
Right on. That says a lot for what is essentially a cover-to-cover book just full of monsters. So that's cool. And I think we have reached the inevitable conclusion of this episode. I want to thank our sponsors, FRP Games and NobleKnightGames.com. Thank you for I want to thank them for their support. And if you visit either one of them, please make sure to let them know that the Vorpal Network sent you, so they will continue supporting us. I also want to thank our guest for the episode, Quinn. What's going on over at the At Will blog these days?
All sorts of great stuff. I've got, well, you've got an article coming out soon, a very cool article. Obviously more Worldbreaker stuff. I actually made an index there. So if you read the stuff on At Will and you like it and you're like, oh, I made one of my own, we actually need to get some of yours up there, Jeff. Then we'll add it on there and we'll just sort of collect the, you know, we have a bunch of cool monsters that people are making and sending in. So stand and be counted and, you know, break stuff.
Yeah, the Worldbreaker stuff changed my game. It's awesome.
I'm glad to hear that. Yeah.
There's a lot that I started doing because of the Worldbreaker concepts. You know, without even building like a true Worldbreaker like you sort of described, there are some ideas within the Worldbreaker that it's like, oh yeah, we've been doing that in, you know, video games forever. Why haven't we stolen that idea? Real quick, why don't you tell us what the Worldbreaker is, so anybody who isn't reading the blog has an idea of what we're talking about?
Basically, the Worldbreaker is a concept of it's sort of taking concept from like the video game bosses of, you know, today and yesterday, and making it your fights more like that. Instead of just having, okay, the monster attacks, does this, it transforms the environment around it and then sort of changes the stakes, changes the state of the world there, and all of a sudden things, you have to fight it in a different way, and then, you know, it might go back to normal, it might switch to something else, you know, and then but keep everything shifting around on there. So it's both a concept, but I also have mechanics that support it. But even if you just use the concept, like Mike, you just used the concept really mostly, but there's benefits to just the concept or the mechanics, I think.
Right, because I think a lot of what I've done is use the mechanics a lot. You know, I didn't necessarily transform the environment on one of the ones I built, but I transformed the creature where, you know, you've got a gnome who's fighting, and then at a certain point he gathers – he's, you know, this master of the trees, right? So at some point he gathers up all the nearby vegetation and becomes this giant, you know, and wears the trees like battle armor, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then I always think of it as kind of phased combat. That combat kind of shifts phases as it goes further and further along, and the phases have to kind of change the whole encounter. And it means that fighting a solo goes from kind of being grindy and boring to something that's really, you know, a lot of fun, and something where the players have to think about, okay, you know, oh my God, he's shifted into this new thing now, and now we got to relearn him again. And I think that's fun for them, and it's fun for us.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. All right, so that's what you've got going on over at the At Will blog.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk to Mike. What's happening over at Sly Flourish?
So big thing is I've got a book coming out. I got a book coming out in a couple of weeks. It's in its last round of edits. I have all the art, and it's going to be published mid-July. I threw a big printed manuscript copy at Quinn when he was over.
Yes, it looks awesome.
Yeah, so it's going to be a short book. It's going to be available in print on demand and in three different ebook formats for your iPad or your Kindle or online or however you want to use it. And it's going to be a short book on Dungeon Master tips. Just, you know, Dungeon Master tips that I've been working on and things that I've talked about on the site a little bit. It's not a rehash of the blog. It's all written fresh, and hopefully it'll help people have better games.
Awesome. And how soon before we can expect to see that ready to go?
It'll be about mid-July. I think about July 15th is when it'll be out. So right,
awesome.
I'll post about it on Twitter and twitter.com/lifeflourish.
Right on.
Nice.
I look forward to getting my my early copy, right?
We'll see what we can do.
All right.
Work. Is this a part where your people call his people?
I have my people.
I want to be able to give like one of those blurbs to put on the cover.
What was this guy thinking?
Exactly. All right. Well, I think that we've had enough fun tonight. This has been episode 140. You can email me at thetomeshow@gmail.com or visit the forums at vorpalnetwork.com, where I've been recently trying to rejuvenate a little bit of some of the cool conversations going on over there. Don't forget to spread the word about the show. The more people in the world that are listening to podcasts, the more great content that can come out through podcasts, and the more people who will do it. So get out there and help spread the word. I'll keep making the content. You get out and spread the word. We'll split the duties that way. And don't forget to consider checking out the Tomes Amazon store for products discussed on the show and more. The show gets part of the proceeds, and it helps keep us on the air. Links for things mentioned in the show can be found in the show notes on the website at thetomeshow.com. We have defeated Ogre Mach. We've bested Loth and Loth, no matter where you put the L. And then we got eaten by a frog. But it was all good while it lasted in this episode 140, Monster Manual 3 of...
I'm on the wall.